Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your comic book and pop culture podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony. This is going to be episode 214, and I'm very, very happy to tonight be hosted by a good friend of the show and fellow podcaster, host of the Comic Shenanigans podcast, Mr. Adam Chapman. Adam, thank you for having me over your home. We're not able to go to the Sky Dome or the Rogers Center this year, but we're watching baseball on the patio deck of your home on a nice big projector, your Jumbotron.
Yeah, we are. It's interesting. A couple of the times we've been to games before, we've seen blowouts. Sometimes we've come back from this. I think in the game we're watching, we're down like 11-1. So it seems about right. This feels like a typical evening for us watching the Jays. So that's, I mean, at least this time we're in the comfort of at least one of our homes.
Yeah.
We don't have to go as far. We're not deep in, you know, downtown Toronto amongst a lot of people getting drunk and angry. But
This is actually quite nice. This is almost, I mean, I love going down to watch a live sports event, but this is a very good, I wouldn't even say a consolation prize. This is better in some ways.
It's intimate, you know. We have a 100-inch screen that we get to watch on, and you know, it's nice.
It's very nice. I really appreciate you guys having me over, and I think it would be a waste of an evening if me and you hang out and we don't podcast. It just seems ridiculous.
It would seem bizarre. So earlier today, when you were like, "I'm bringing my mic," I'm like, "Well, I'd expect nothing less from a baseball event with Eric." I mean, that's my favorite. I think is last year when we recorded virtually the entire game, and like didn't even take a breath, right? And,
right,
and then the game was like, oh, we better stop because the game is over, and the people behind us are like, what are you doing?
Yeah, who are you guys?
Yeah, what are you guys doing here?
I think I told them you were a director of a movie or something. She goes, really? And I was gonna play a prank on her and make it some adult film, but it may have gone wrong. But anyways, we've been talking for the last hour, and some of it should have been recorded. But I guess we just continue where we left off. We've been talking about obviously comic books and collecting, and some of our collecting habits in the last little while. I blame you. I've told you this before. you had me join the one of those Facebook pages like Omnibus Collectors and stuff like that, and I've been on a omnibus buying spree. I also blame Near Mint Condition and Gem Mint. I think I actually can pinpoint, I don't know the date, but the moment when things changed. Yeah.
Okay. When was the moment?
So heavily influenced by the pandemic.
Okay.
Because sitting at home, you have almost a completely shift of time, downtime, family time, where you're not going out, you're not getting together with friends the way you used to. All those sort of social norms that became ways of getting together with people, it's not an option.
No.
So there was 2 weeks where it was a lot of unknowns happening in our city, where everything was virtually shut down. And it was I didn't mind.
Is it wrong that part of me almost opines for that time?
No.
Only because it seems so simple. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like everyone was at home.
Yeah.
And you weren't allowed to go anywhere.
Yeah.
And no stores were open. And you didn't have to wonder about what stores were open or what hours they were open now or what you had to do at a certain, like, the etiquette. Like, it was simple, scary, but simple. And then you just kind of stayed home. And
I love that.
And everyone was at home. And, like, if you called someone, they were home.
Yeah.
You know, like, it sounds almost quaint, you know, like, because we're so used to everyone kind of being on the go, on the, you know, everyone's always doing something. And suddenly, everyone was home. You called someone, like, when I was doing my work, I would call someone, they were at home. I didn't have to worry about catching them, you know, at a bad time, or they're out or in their car. They were at home because they weren't going anywhere. And that part was kind of nice, this weird shared experience that we all had. I've said this before, probably on podcasts and other places, but, you know, back in the, you know, earlier TV era when you had like three or four networks, everyone had a shared experience, right? Because there was only three or four different experiences you could have. So, you know, you'd be watching TV and most people would be watching, you know, that as well. Well, at least 25% of people would probably be watching that thing because everyone had this community experience. But as our society has become more fragmented, we lose that a little bit because there's so many different types of content. Like, you know, you could be watching the best thing you've ever seen and no one could ever have heard of it because they don't have that streaming platform or this or that. So having that shared experience starts to go away a little. But suddenly everyone's at home at the same time, dealing with the same thing, and you can call them and everyone knows exactly what you're talking about. You know, you're like, oh, how's the pandemic treating you? And everyone knows exactly what you're talking about and how, and what you're getting at. And everyone has the same type of stories. And I think that is an interesting part of kind of coming together, even though we're all apart, is that we all have this shared experience where in a lifetime, in an era when we have more and more fragmented experiences, it's nice to, as weird as it is to say it's nice to have a shared experience, but like, it's an awful thing to have happen. And I do come from a place of privilege where I'm blessed that my work wasn't impacted. I work for a major bank. I wasn't impacted. I was able to continue doing my job. My wife works for a major law firm, or not a major law firm, but like a sizable enough international law firm. She was able to keep doing her job. We're both able to work from home. We weren't financially impacted. So I understand that I come from a place of privilege and that I'm very lucky to be able to do that and that I wasn't impacted. But, you know, it's been an interesting time.
No, I completely agree with you.
And I don't know what my point was.
No, we were just talking about that downtime.
Yeah.
Like, it you're absolutely right.
Well, I felt like I had a lot less. I was actually really jealous because I was still working.
Yeah.
And my wife was still working. And we had our son was very busy and taxing because he had nothing else to do. So all of his, it's actually one of those weird things where when we were in the pandemic for the first 2 months, he would be walking around our house being like, I'm bored. I got to do this. I got to do that. We're trying to get him to do homework, but we don't actually have time to do the homework with him because, again, we're both working full-time jobs. Then we adopt this beautiful little girl who comes into our life in June. So June 1st, she comes home and lives with us. She's ours now. She's amazing. She's, you know, the light of our lives. Suddenly, my wife is on parental leave, so she spends all day in my daughter's room and just, you know, hanging out with her, making sure she's okay. And then my son will be there with them, and he's like, ugh, I'm going to go to my room and read. I'm like, you can do that? Like, for the last couple months, you were constantly in our sphere, could not get out of our faces more. He was always constantly in our face. And then suddenly, he's bored of hanging out with his baby sister. He's like, nah, I'm going to peace out and go read in my room. And I'm like, all right, where was this kid 3 months ago? I would have loved this kid. Like, I would not have wanted to strangle this child if he had wanted to do this before. And I was just like, what is wrong with you? Because, you know, you can have too much togetherness. But I felt like a lot of people that I was like, I had, you know, Facebook friends and stuff, you know, their work was shut down or they weren't able to work. So they were like, you know, binging a lot of shows, just chilling, reading. And I'm like, fuck, that sounds amazing. Instead, yeah. My business was, if anything, even busier because the entire world collapsed in March. So all the markets were down. Every client's calling me. What do I do about my money? I'm freaking out. So I'm busier than ever. I'm working from home, trying to make that work. My wife's trying to make that work. Our son's going crazy. So I felt a little bit of a weird jealousy about people who legitimately were probably financially impacted by not being able to go to work. But I was just like, no, it sounds a little nice to just have a little bit of time where I couldn't do work and I could just read or do something. Because that might, as my wife will tell you, I went on a trip to, sorry, I'm just kind of free-flowing all over the place. Last year I went to Dominican Republic with my brother-in-law and my sister-in-law's ex-boyfriend. I always want to call him my brother-in-law, but he's not really my brother-in-law, so I feel like that's not the right title. But I went on this trip to the Dominican with them, and my bare minimum, all I really wanted from that week was to read tons of comics. I wanted to be like, I don't have to do anything for anyone. I'm going to sit on the beach. I'm going to read as many comics as possible. I remember your pictures from when you were in Cuba, I think, with your wife, just reading everywhere. And I'm like, man, that looks fucking great. There's no kid jumping at you, getting in the way of reading Young Justice or JSA or whatever it was.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, no, that sounds so good. I want that. So I'm sitting on the beach reading like issues of Back Issue magazine. I'm like, this is all I wanted in life. So if I had the opportunity during the initial time of the pandemic to do that, I would have been a very happy camper. Instead, I was seeing, like, you were like, oh, I'm reading all this stuff. I'm like, man, that sounds great. Can I do this?
Yeah. And it didn't last long for me. I thought it was going to be a lot longer. I was kind of hoping in a way it would be because, one, my line of work requires me to go there. I couldn't work remotely. So I was a little bit trepidatious for sure about going back to work on a construction site when you're supposed to be scared of touching everything, right? When your whole job is tactile, you're like, how are we going to be safe?
Of course.
So I was in a mindset of like, I'm not going to be going anywhere for a while. And we both know what it's like when I think we are kind of broke it down recently, especially when I talked to the comic shop owner from Cyber City, Daryl. There's those, you've got collectors, then consumers, and then people who collect collections, mm-hmm. right? So you got your weekly guys trying to stay on top of stuff, which we have a knack of doing. I don't do it as much anymore, but we do. Mm-hmm. And then we also collect with the sense of talking to people. Mm-hmm. So then you're not just into your, you know, Image Comics line. It's like, yeah. Well, I'm going to be talking to, you know, Tom DeFalco. Mm-hmm. So I got to go back and read some old stuff.
Can I actually ask you a random question about that?
Yeah.
Of all your time of doing all the different podcast interviews you've done, what has been kind of the biggest surprise of something you had never read, mm-hmm. never, maybe you've never heard anything of, that you tried just because you were going to interview X creator and it blew you away?
It's a good question.
Was it J.M. DeMatteis?
I already like J.M. DeMatteis, but I ended up...
Everyone loves J.M. DeMatteis, but he's done a lot of stuff off the beaten path,
yes.
that a lot of people don't always know about.
That definitely changed it. I think you, I'd be remiss to say that it wasn't that, because probably his writing and him as a person and digging into his psychology of books changed me as a person.
It's interesting when you read some of his darker stuff, you almost expect him to be a bit more dark and twisty, but he couldn't be more from that. You know, he's
so
such
pleasant.
He's a really charming individual, and he just seems like...
He feels like what sunshine looks like when you talk to him.
Honestly, yeah. You know, I was going to say kind of hippie-ish, but mm-hmm. like, yeah, he feels like a very genuine person.
Yeah.
And whenever you talk to him, you know, some people write because they like to write, but like he feels like he is creativity.
Yes.
You know, like, and he likes to channel it like jazz. You know, creativity and writing comics to him, or writing any type of prose, is kind of like jazz to him. Like, he's kind of finding the moment, and he finds the rhythm, and he kind of rides the rhythm along. And sometimes it brings him into one place, sometimes it brings him into another. Whereas other writers, you can feel that they're thinking about it, there's a process, or it's very different. Like, I don't think you can ever read Bendis and feel like it's jazz. I think it feels far too thought out, and that's not a bad thing.
No.
It's just, I think there's just something about when you read someone like DeMatteis that it feels so elegant, like it's smooth. Like somehow this all just works. And like, even when you talk to him, like he doesn't always know exactly where he's going to go, but he kind of lives through his characters and they kind of find the story for him. And when some people talk about that, it could sound hackneyed. But when you hear him talk, it's just like, can you tell me more? You know, like it's just so real. It there's no bullshit. It's the unvarnished truth. It's just, this is just who he is. He channels stories. And every interview I've ever listened to him is so fascinating. Like, there are a number of creators who I just love to hear talk. It doesn't matter if I've heard the story before. I want to hear, like, Mark Waid's one. Like, he could talk about anything. I don't think I'd ever get bored.
I agree. That's a guy where, if I haven't read what, like, you've had him on a few times now, and I haven't read Cross Gen.
That's how I've been getting him on. I'm like, hey, you want to talk about this weird thing that no one ever asked you about? He's like, all right, sure. I'm like, cool, let's do this.
With somebody like him, because I've read a lot of his work, I wouldn't even zero in on a particular run, as opposed to the theory behind how he sees these characters in these universes, because he's an encyclopedia, but he also likes to, in the way that J.M. DeMatteis does on almost a spiritual level, Mark Waid does on like a scientific level, where he'll take these characters that, like, Fantastic Four is an interesting one because he wasn't a fan of the Fantastic Four, but he did something that everybody loves about them without being like, this guy, what the hell is he doing? He doesn't even know these characters. Mm-hmm. He tapped into something that is just so genuine.
His is an interesting run, too, because if you read that, like, that first issue, I would say is a great primer to anybody. You know, this will make you a fan of the Fantastic Four. It's really simple, but it really pulls things back and makes it very simple to understand who these characters are. You don't ever have to have read anything about the Fantastic Four before. You can jump right in. But what's so interesting about it is, you read that last issue, it's a complete full circle. Like, it's such an emotional moment at the end of that run, and it feels earned because that's what he was doing the entire time.
Right.
You know, and if you read that first issue and the last issue, you can see a line there.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of waviness in the middle, but really it's all about one big thing. It's interesting to read, again, his, because I don't think of him necessarily, and I don't mean this in a negative, but I don't think of Mark Waid necessarily as an emotional writer.
Right.
But his that run was very emotional, and I think a lot of that maybe was Waringo's influence as well. Whereas then and FF is an interesting beast, because then you read something like Jonathan Hickman, it works on an emotional level too, but it's so much more like intellectual level.
Yeah,
you know,
cerebral thing too.
Yeah, he was doing the long game, you know, and it's funny. I think you're the one who sent me the podcast that Hickman did with Off Panel, I guess it was,
yeah, yep.
And which I think is the only time I've ever heard him speak, and he did not have the voice I expected. It was a little bit more, I don't know if this will make sense, but I expected his voice to sound like Jason Aaron looks. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You've seen what Jason Aaron looks like. So I kind of expected the voice to kind of fit like that, and it was not that. But it was really fascinating to hear him talk about design and his, you know, his thoughts, and you can see how he articulates things. I really apologize. I'm all over the place.
Today. No.
But, getting back to FF, yeah, he's not an emotional writer, whereas Wade's FF definitely was, but I don't think of him as an emotional writer, whereas DeMatteis is very emotional, but also very introspective.
Yes.
In terms of, you know, he's not scared to really... Fuck, another home run? Sorry. Sorry to talk about a game that will be long overdue at this point, but another home run. Like, DeMatteis is just such a... I'm more interested in reading work by him now, after having listened to him, than I... that being said, I loved him before. He's done amazing work, but something about hearing him talk and knowing how he operates, and he's just such a lovely individual. I think that's really what it is. You know, like,
yeah.
you see him on Facebook or Twitter, and when he engages with people, it's very genuine. It never feels false. It feels like he's really happy that people are talking about anything he did and that it meant something to them. He often will chime in on the why hasn't Marvel collected, you know, a lot of his spectacular Spider-Man run, because it's available in other countries but not in North America. He's great.
Yeah, no,
and he's your best friend, right?
I wish. Not. I'm trying to get into the Adam Chapman category of friendliness with creators. You and Ron Friends have a cottage together in Pennsylvania.
Oh, that'd be amazing. It's a bummer, because I was supposed to go to Pittsburgh this year to watch the Blue Jays play, and I was supposed to have lunch with Ron Friends. I was really excited. And I guess I'll have to, you know, see if we can get a rain check on that someday.
It'll happen. But that's a great question, and I've talked to a lot of other people too who aren't comic book fans and told them about DeMatteis, his work, because I think it transcends the superhero genre. Like, it digs deeper into something else psychologically, and for me, I was going through certain changes in life, and sometimes something hits where it's like, oh, this person is speaking to me in a way that I didn't know I would find here.
Yeah.
Because whatever I'm changing or feeling in life, you feel like it's got to be from, you know, some type of literature or therapy, or and his work, like Brooklyn Dreams or Moonshadow,
yeah.
Even some of his Spider-Man stuff. One of them was a Green Lantern, Willpower. I think it was Willpower. That was another one where I'm reading, I'm like, this
is...
Yes, Will World. Yes, that's the one. And I heard him on another show.
See, sometimes I know things.
You do. You know stuff. You're my encyclopedia. You and Sam Noir and Kevin Boyd are my three, like, go-tos. Do you know? One of you is going to know. And another one would have been Fabian Nicieza, who was a writer that I knew had a very celebrated career as far as X-Men was concerned. New Warriors and Deadpool, of course, and Cable. His Deadpool and Cable was way more than I expected. I knew people loved it, but it really hit a note for me that I didn't expect it would.
Mm.
I like that book a lot, and I'm really glad that I gave that series a chance and that I got to speak to him. Another one wasn't a person I interviewed, but was a book club that I did with Shane and Martin, which was Planetary.
Oh, yeah.
Not a book that I had any desire to read. There's as much of a...
I didn't realize that was that recent for you.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was. I know you've loved it, and I know you were talking about like the you know the omnibus or whatever, what have you, about it. So I didn't realize that was a relatively recent thing for you.
Yeah, it was. It was Warren Ellis is a very recent creator that I discovered. Really? Yeah, yeah. I know he's super celebrated. He's been extreme.
Like 25 years.
He's been around forever. Yeah, but
where
his
have you been?
Exactly in the cave, reading Batman and Superman. But I read so many things, but there's a ton of stuff that, you know, as a comic book collector and reader, it's like, you didn't read this? You haven't read that? Like, I've never read Preacher, and I know everybody...
I've read a bit of it. I never really liked it. But that was years ago when I tried it. I also could never really get, and maybe it was the art, I don't know, into Transmetropolitan, which, again, is the big Ellis kind of love letter, but I never really got into that. I mean, that book itself is like 20 years old now. Like, it's so old. But I never really got into that either. It's one of... I would say Preacher and Transmet are probably two of those books where I'm kind of embarrassed that I haven't read, because I know they're kind of like the thing. Yeah, it's weird when you come across those.
Yeah,
those
I've never
books,
read
right?
Sandman.
Yeah.
I never read Starman from James Robinson.
So, I want to. And every time
I'm going
to.
Try,
I find the art kind of puts me off at the beginning. I don't know if you've noticed that DC seems that their new publishing strategy for some of these collected editions is the giant compendiums. They have a Fables one, I think, coming out this month or October. So I think it has like 40-something issues, but it's soft cover.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that's going to look like. I guess they're kind of emulating Saga did that.
Actually, I saw them when I was in Montreal because I was debating on getting the Ex Machina in omnibus or the compendium. Cause
I didn't know they did that in the compendium too.
Yeah, it's a nice little package.
How many pages is the compendium?
It's the first 25, the first
that's
half.
It's not a compendium.
No, it isn't the phone
like
book.
40. Come on.
It isn't, but the whole series is 50 issues, right? So the omnibus was all of it, and then they split it in two compendiums. That's a little bit more easier to read. So I was debating, but I found
that seems more reasonable to me because it's not quite as unwieldy. Like I love Fables, but I only have some of the scattershot trade paperbacks when they first started coming out.
Yeah.
And to get them all would be so much of a pain in the ass to do. So the fact that I can get the first, I think it's 41 issues or 50, something like that, in one big soft cover is exciting. And it's like $70, which isn't too bad.
No, it's
but they're
not.
Doing the same thing with Starman. There's a bunch of them all coming out from DC. I don't know where this new publishing model is coming from. The problem with DC is you never know if they're going to continue something. They're not really great at that. I mean, you can easily online see a lot of people bitching and complaining about DC's collections. They stop and start all the time. Marvel's really consistent, and you kind of know what to expect. And when they start a line, you kind of know they're going to continue. Whereas DC, you don't know if they're going to cancel it or not, or come back to it in 2 years. I'm hoping the Fables does. I mean, so far, Volume 2's already been solicited, so that's, or at least advanced solicited, so that's exciting. But that's one of those things.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? Like you said, there's these series that the way that they're collected, it becomes like a whole new thing to get into. I'm going to have to get 6 hardcovers to read that. I don't know if I want 6 hardcovers of that particular series on my shelf or to go through that. So
I wrestled with getting the Clone Saga for Spider-Man because I have the original complete Clone Saga Epics, whatever giant mouthful there was in that name. And I remember when they were coming out, like I was like hotcakes in my hand. Like I could not wait. I could not believe that this was happening. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, they're actually doing this. Oh my God. And then they're like, oh, we're doing it on omnibus, and it's like a recut, like it's a different order, which I do appreciate more because I never really liked the order in the Clone Saga Epics because they put the lost years in a weird, not, and I would have put it, like, I don't know how you do that, but I think I would have preferred it being publication date, not chronological date, because it kind of undercuts what you get later, because now you think you're, you know, I don't know if you've read
stuff,
but like
we did podcasts together about it.
That's right. Okay, so the whole I don't know things. So the whole point of like the lost years is all to explain Ben Reilly's early story, and everywhere in there he thinks he's the real Peter Parker. So it's really weird to read that and then go into the rest of the Clone Saga where he doesn't know yet until you eventually catch up to it. So it's just a weird. So that's the only reason I ever thought about the omnibus is for more than a second. But other than that, I was like, I'm never going to read this. Mm-hmm. Like the epics, I feel like I could pick them off my shelf and I could read them. But having like, I don't know, 4,800 pages and 4 gigantic omnibuses didn't really appeal to me in the same way.
Yeah, it's true. It depends on how things are going to be collected. And it suddenly can change from I don't want to read that to, oh, that looks like a great way to read it in one place. You have it all.
Well, like, I think, I don't know what the math is, but I think in like 4 or 5 years, I'm going to have every Amazing Spider-Man issue in trade. Like, almost every issue. Like, the epics are going to get you up to the Clone Saga, or at least that's the conventional wisdom. And then I have the Clone Saga, and then I have, like, there's nothing comprehensive doing the Clone Saga to the next chapter. But there's a couple trades in there, which I do own, but there's still a bunch of issues that haven't been collected. Then you got the next chapter, which has issues, I think, 1 to 20. Then you have the Revenge of the Green Goblin, which gets you up to issue 30. Then you have JMS coming on for his 5 volumes, of which our copies of volume 5 are still in Alabama. Eventually, they're going to come here. They've been sitting there for 8 months. The shipping was so high that I was like, okay, wait till I buy something else, and then you can ship it up to me. But that'll get, you know, all of JMS's run. Then you have the Big Time Era. Brand New Day. Brand New Day, then there's a couple trades after that, the big, thicker ones that collect everything up into Big Time. We're only missing at this point the Gauntlet Volume 2, which is about to come out. And then after that, I think there's one more trade that they haven't solicited, but hopefully we'll fill in the gap. Then you got Big Time. Big Time brings you up to Superior, and then Superior, everything else since. So I have everything in trade
in some capacity.
So once the epics are done, in terms of Amazing Spider-Man, I will have almost every issue of Amazing Spider-Man collected, which is really exciting to me. Which is, like, I can have that on my shelf and be like, son, you don't want to read this, but here's 900 issues. Good luck. Talk to me in a couple years.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a pandemic and you can read more.
And he's going to say, where's all the spectacular, Dad?
Oh, fuck. Dad, I don't know what's going on. They're talking about other books.
Yeah.
I think I'm missing something. I'm like,
yeah.
You know, why do you have this Roger Stern omnibus? Isn't it most of it in the epic? Yeah, but there's this spectacular issues that aren't collected anywhere else.
It's true.
Fuck.
Don't start me on another collection.
Yeah, don't. I'm already upset about this enough, son. You know, don't bring it up. So.
Yeah.
I don't know what brought me in that diatribe. Sorry. But.
No. We started off by me blaming you.
Oh, well, that's okay.
Yeah.
As long as we know that. So... In the pandemic era, how many omnibuses have you bought?
I don't want to say.
Really? Enough that you don't want to say.
You know what it was? I don't buy single issues.
No.
Weekly. And I haven't bought as many trades. Okay. So...
Let me ask a different question then. Are you buying... Or do you find that the omnibuses you're buying are 60s material, 70s material, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s?
It's everything.
Which would you say is the most?
Oh.
The most concentration of where your dollars have gone.
That's a hard... I think it's mostly... late 90s to into the 2000s. The aughts and the tens, so I would say.
What do you think it is about that period that has piqued your omnibus buying interest?
I think it's just... So one of the things
stuff you missed?
Some of it's stuff that I missed. So, getting back to that original thing that I was saying was, I was one night during the pandemic when I was at home in the late March, early April.
One magical night,
yeah. When time seemed to not matter, I was now saying, you know what? I don't have to go anywhere. Holding this big book is not a problem, which was always the thing that turned me off of an omnibus. Because, like, it's so big. What's the point? It's stupid. I'd rather read a beefy trade. But I had that X-Men Fatal Attractions, which I had spoken on those road reports. I'm like, I want to get to this. This is my goal. I want to read this hardcover.
Is the hardcover or the
hardcover.
Okay.
So it was finally I got to, it was an omnibus size, basically, 900 pages.
Oh, yeah, it should have been called them
omnibus. It should have been.
Absolutely.
So
a ton of those X-Men books.
For no reason. Yeah. So I got to that book, and I said, I'm going to finish this. And it felt daunting because I don't have usually the patience to sit with one long book, and that's the only thing I'm reading. Mm. I always, like, 12 issues here, six issues of that, jump to this now.
Well, that one does help because you're reading, like, 4 or 5 different books.
Exactly.
Right? Like, it's not like you're just getting one story. You're getting many stories.
Exactly. So, I was on such an X-Men binge for a while. I said, I enjoyed reading Fatal Attraction so much in this format at home where everything is there, and I felt like I got so much story that I was late at night, my wife falling asleep on the couch, it was maybe 1 o'clock in the morning. She likes having background noise, so I was watching one of those review YouTube review for Uncanny X-Force.
Oh yeah.
So I saw it on Jem Mint.
Yeah.
He did. He's like, this is one of my favorite books, and I knew I love that book. And then Omar did the same on Near Mint. And I said, I got to see if this is available, because this is one that I would want to own, an X-Men book that I'd love to have in omnibus form.
Everything you're saying so far, it sounds like just the, you know, 2020 equivalent of like a 1980s infomercial of like a guy falls asleep on the couch, wakes up, the infomercial's on, yep, grabs his attention. Yep. I need this thing, yep, right now.
Yeah.
I got to buy this for 6 equal payments,
yeah,
of this, this, this.
And why I jumped on it, I went on Amazon, and it was 36% on sale. So I said, you know what?
It's meant to be.
And the way that the things
were... If
your
wife had been up, would you have bought it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It wasn't a matter that she was...
Do you have an allowance that she... Like, watch your spending in terms of your omnibuses?
She doesn't watch. She doesn't, like... What did you do this with? She's, you know what it is? It's
a weird question, but
no,
like,
no, but she does. We do have like a spending thing. Okay. And before it was, let's take out cash to keep track of it, okay, and be disciplined. But because of the new normal, that's not, you're not caring that much anymore. For a time, people weren't accepting it.
No.
And you weren't even going out. So when I ordered those books, and then you, again, I'm blaming you because you sent me a message about Astonishing X-Men.
Oh, yeah.
That had a one of those today's deals.
Oh yeah.
So I jumped on that one. The prices. So I watch Amazon like stocks.
Yeah.
And when I see books fall to the price that I'm comfortable with, then I jump on it.
Yeah.
So I got the Uncanny X-Force.
Yeah. And once in a while, I'll see something at a good deal, and I'm like, well, I better send it to Eric.
I do the same, right? I'm like, maybe he'll want this. I don't know. And so
it is funny to hear you talk about it like stocks.
Yeah.
You know, like it is kind of our stock. It's like, oh, this stock is really hot right now, or it's really low right now. You should really get on this.
And then the things disappear because you realize, like, this, people have been waiting for this reprint, or people have been waiting for this format to have this collected. Mm-hmm. And then before you know it, especially with Marvel books, they're gone. And you just and you listen to, you know, Rhett Thomas and other people who are into the collecting, mm-hmm, and you're like, how did this epic collection come out? And now I'm ready to buy it because I've caught up to reading whatever. Mm-hmm. I want this next Iron Man, yeah, and it's a whale.
Yeah.
So there's that FOMO that kicks in.
Well, it does feel like a lot of those books have been going back to print lately.
Right.
It's one of the. It's interesting to see how the Epic Collection kind of group on Facebook that Curtis started has really blossomed. Like, it's huge. Like, it's a mammoth beast of its own.
Yeah.
And I follow a couple little lines, so I feel like a noob compared to some of these people who are like buying every volume. They have like 150 Epics so far.
Their whole shelf.
It's all Epics.
It's all Epics, like, and it looks good.
It does look good.
It looks really good.
There's something about having them all together, right? I only have a few, but it still makes me happy. Actually, like, so here's a question. How do you store your soft covers? Like, are you an alphabetical guy? Are you by character?
I'm alphabetical. I have two shelves.
If your spine says Amazing Spider-Man, do you put it with an A for Amazing or S for Spider-Man?
Spider-Man.
Yeah?
I put it in Spider-Man.
I put it for Amazing.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
I end up with Amazing Spider-Man over here and Spider-Man over here. But, like, it feels weird otherwise.
Yeah, I do it by... So I guess the answer would be by character. So, like, Action Comics is with Superman. I put the books in the chronological order, okay, of the...
I don't do that either. I do the alphabetical by the name of the trade.
Okay.
It's weird. I don't even know if I like it anymore. But, like, I have so many trades. As I said off podcast, like, I have some stuff that's not even with my main stuff anymore. It's, like, in my garage.
I'm so, getting to that point.
So, like, I don't know what to do anymore. And at some point, I love to merge things. And, like, I have a lot of trades from, like, the old new Marvel Now kind of era where it was all white spines,
yeah,
with, like,
yeah, yeah,
with a little bit of red at the top. And then they eventually changed it so that now you had a larger color bottom with part of the character. Mm-hmm. So you had, like, the early era of the old new Marvel Now and then, like, the later era. But I can't put those near my other trades because they don't match. So I have to keep them separate. So like you have like the, because they're all white spines, right? Except for like the Warzone trades and like Secret Wars that are like black spines. You're like, oh my god, but this doesn't match anything. Like, what are you doing to us, Marvel? It's weird. I
collect their OCD.
I think about it once in a while, just like how, what would be the better way to collect this? And I don't know. There's no best way.
And that's the thing, right? Is that now that
I keep my epics segregated from the rest. I keep my epics. Again, alphabetical, and then I go into my regular trades. So they're on their own. So they look nice all together, but like I don't have all my Spider-Mans together because I have the epics here, and then I have the alphabetical Amazing Spider-Man here. I have alphabetical Spider-Man over here, and then I have everything in Old and Marvel Now, which is somewhere else, because all those match together.
So with that said, it makes me think of how I've done my collection, and basically, I've done it in a weird way for my wife.
Okay. Where, so if you're dead, she can find stuff?
Basically, if you want to get into Daredevil,
yeah.
The first Daredevil that I have on that shelf is where you can start and read that way.
Okay.
So it'll be it'll be Daredevil Yellow.
Interesting. That's where you'd start?
I don't have anything earlier, like in the epic format of like early Daredevil. So here's a story
chronologically,
right? So there's that.
But it kind of buries the lead that Karen's dead.
It does. It does spoil that.
Like, whoa, whoa, whoa!
Right.
If you ever see Karen again in the story, she's gonna die.
That's true. So that's there, and then the next ones would be the Frank Millers, followed by.
Which version of that do you have?
The red spines. I think they're like...
Oh, yeah. That's more modern. I used to have the older ones. The
visionary ones?
Yeah, but they like they changed in the middle. And, like, yeah, they were weird. I actually don't even know if they're on my shelf anymore, to be honest. I don't think they are. Because at some point, I bought the Daredevil omnibus, which, again, was a weird-looking omnibus because it doesn't match any of the other omnibuses. Because it's got, like, a red spine. And everything else is black spine.
And that's an omnibus that I would probably...
The old omnibuses where it's just the black covers and not, like, a regular, like a lot of the modern omnibuses, they have like a cover art, right? Like if you take off the cover, the dust jacket.
Oh yeah, yeah, I have some of those. Like the.
Do you have ones that are just black?
Yeah.
Do you have the ones that feel like pleather?
No, not Marvel. I don't have those Marvel.
I got those.
Yeah, you go back.
I don't have a lot of them, but I have a couple of them, and I remember lamenting the changeover when they went to just having like the matte black, and I didn't have that feel because there was something special about that, like this is like a special book.
Right.
And then they took that away, but it was still black, and now everything has like cover art, and it's different. It's a different vibe. Because I used to love taking the jackets off, and you just again just because they all look the same. There's just this uniformity, but it was really gorgeous.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I wonder.
Such collection nerds. But the worst part is, we're not even that bad.
No, we're not, because we collect a little bit of everything.
Yes.
We're all over the map with it.
Can you imagine if you were one of those people who really bought into the essentials and was like, "Fuck it, the essentials are my jam," and then they're gone, and now the epics have replaced them, and like. They were really cool for the time because they're so cheap. The showcases were the same at DC. I have a few of the showcases ones. I think I have like the first three of the Flash. I think I have like a World's Finest, and like they're so much fun. But they were cheap. They were like phone books, and they were like less than $20. And you couldn't really beat them in terms of how much content you got. Yes, it was black and white, but it was kind of cool.
Yeah, no, I had the first Essentials Amazing Spider-Man. Oh, yeah. Were the first 20 issues of. The classic run.
What was the design on the... Sorry, this is such a weird inside baseball question, but like, what was the design of the Essentials that you owned? Because they changed numerous different times what the design was.
I think it was an early one.
Yeah?
I think it... Because it was at a time when I wasn't really collecting comics that much, but I wanted to get something that was, the like you said, the best bang for your buck. Mm-hmm. And that one, it was black and white, but it was like, this is classic Spider-Man, and you get 20 issues for $20, and I had... A very limited budget, and
I have
also
exactly $20.
Yeah, yeah.
Give me my comics right now.
Exactly, and I had that for many, many years, but I didn't find myself with the desire to read it as much because it was older books in black and white. So it was like it is classic, but
yeah. I remember buying the Showcase Presents World's Finest and liking that, and I felt that one you could read black and white, and it didn't really detract too much. But then I got the Flash, and I love the Flash. And I love those old stories. They're so silly. But I felt like it not being in color really did detract something. Mm-hmm. There's just something about, I think Flash needs to be in color in a way that Superman and Batman don't. I don't know why. I just think it was just something about...
I think the color of the Flash, it's like Green Lantern. There's something so associated with their color that it, when it's not in color, it doesn't do the character justice.
Green Lantern I find frustrating because oftentimes they'll get such a bland colorist, and I'm like, what are you doing? Like, he has to... Like, the color is the most important part of the book.
With Green Lantern especially.
Yeah, like when Skyver was doing it in like Rebirth, like I don't know who was coloring it at the time, but that colorist was fucking bang up, like amazing. Like the color had a life of its own. Like the green jumped off the page. You could feel it. It really did shine.
That's what I'm reading right now, actually. I went back and a lot of the things that I'm also getting in omnibus format are some of my favorite books. That I just want to...
You don't want the complete collections? Because, I mean, obviously, Green Lantern, you could.
No.
No?
No, I like the uniformity of that particular run, where it's like, this is all Geoff Johns. I know that I like 90% of it quite a bit. And, when you see it... this is the thing. You jump on something, it's like, ooh, that's a good deal. Let me get that while I can. It's like, oh, but now I only have volume one.
Yeah. My problem with any of the Geoff Johns Green Lantern stuff, looking back, is that I remember I had the GLC trades up until, I guess, Sinestro Corps War. And after that, I bought all the singles. And I wish that they would collect all the GLC stuff, because you couldn't, like... At times, GLC was actually better than Green Lantern. Like, getting Green Lantern Core was actually better. But there's no way to collect that. Like, they don't care. They care about the Geoff Johns written stuff, but they don't care about anything else that was going on during that period. And I kind of miss that.
And you like the GLC better?
At times, yeah, because it was a team book. That's true. You had a lot more characters, and they made me care about characters I never would have thought I could have cared of. I mean, I love Hal more than like anybody, but there was just something about the Core. The Core was really interesting because they used it that way. They used it as an avenue to explore different types of characters in a way that you weren't used to. You're used to getting Hal, but you're not used to getting Sodom Yat or one of those, or Aresia. You know, these are characters who usually are just supporting cast. Suddenly they get to take over the, you know, it's kind of the magic of reading a book like Gotham Central. You have these characters that have existed for a while in many cases, but they were always supporting characters. They didn't matter. They were picking up the pieces from whatever crazy new, you know, Joker thing that happened or Batman fight, but they weren't the primary protagonist. And suddenly you're reading a story that was all about them, and that Batman was the supporting character, which is, again, to this day, so phenomenal because it wasn't about him at all. It was about everyone else. And, there's something special about something like that.
Yeah. That's another one that I'd love to have that I missed the boat on.
Yeah, I really regret not getting the omnibus. Like, I had the original trades that were nice, but they omitted some issues. And then I got the hardcovers that replaced those issues. But I really wish I had the omnibus. But it's one of those things where I think I had the chance, and I was like, I already own it in hardcover.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I'd said that numerous times. And to be honest, I feel like if I saw it on sale right now, I'd probably still say the same thing. Like, I want it, but I'd be like, I already own it. I don't need to buy it again. Although Stefano Gaudiano pointed out that he was really upset that if you look at the hardcovers, Michael Lark's name is quite a bit smaller than Ed Brubaker and Greg Rucka. And he just took umbrage to that and thought that wasn't really fair, and that Michael Lark was just as important to the creation of Gotham Central, and really that book would not have worked if you hadn't had Michael Lark creating the look of that book and those characters and really setting it up like a TV show. And then I looked and saw that on the omnibus they actually did have his name, just as big as the others. So part of me, just for, you know, sake of appreciating a creator, wishes I had the omnibus that properly credited him in the same font and size as the two writers, because he really did deserve that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, there's a certain...
I never would have noticed that, honestly, if he hadn't brought that up, though. Like, it was really fascinating to me, because he picked up on that. It was something he noticed and cared about. And I love those books, but I don't know if I ever really thought about it or looked at the hardcovers and noticed that they significantly made his name look smaller. I wouldn't have noticed that, and it made me more conscious of that kind of stuff.
It could perhaps be because he wasn't the artist through the whole series.
Yeah, but you could say the same thing about Greg Rucka or Ed Brubaker, really. Neither one of them contributed all 40 issues. You know, they, for a lot of times, they were switching on and off. So there was issues that you didn't even get Greg Rucka at all. It was just Ed Brubaker. But you're still getting Michael Lark. And again, he created the design. He created the, you know, if you had...
The feel of the world is from
like
him.
Like, if another writer had come on near the end, do you think his name would have been shrunk or would have been the same size? I mean, this is conjecture and we don't know that, but I feel like generally it feels like certain companies will put our writer's name higher on the marquee than the artist.
I think usually the writer always gets the higher thing on the marquee because a lot of times they might be the constant on a book, and people will refer to the story they think in their mind, like, that guy wrote it, and the artist is like a director. So it's one of those weird things where, like, in movies, we think of the director as the maker of the movie, and we don't always consider the screenwriter or the screenplay as being as important as Steven Spielberg, when really, you know...
he needs a good script to make it work.
Right. Whereas in comics, the artist is doing the majority of the heavy lifting.
For sure.
Right.
I mean, in script format, there is a fair bit of the writer kind of imposing what they want. So it's not like, you know, when Jack Kirby was doing it, even more so to your point, he was doing everything. You know, he got a plot, and then he would make it all work, and then it was up to Stan to kind of make the words work. But he already had the visuals. It's like watching a silent film and just figuring out what they were going to say. Not quite as hard, because all the work's been done for you. You know, in the full script format, you are getting more of that description, so that in the panel work, like, there's less you having to figure out how you're going to make the story work. And there are some artists who I feel like these days probably wouldn't work in this Jack Kirby format, because it's a lot harder. You have to be really imaginative to get a plot and just make it all work and come up with all the angles, all the, you know, everything about how it's going to look, with having no control over the dialogue whatsoever. And then you're putting, like, dialogue notes, but they may be ignored, which is often what happened with Kirby and Lee. Whereas you have, you know, these guys now, which get full direction. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's a lot easier, although maybe a little less creative at times.
Yeah, it's true. So, yeah, this year, my reading habit, I've read a lot more comics, but my reading habit has changed, where I enjoy the hefty hardcover and feeling like I'm in that universe for a little bit longer. So, like, I spent a lot of time.
Where do you read them?
I read them at home. I got a room. I have, okay.
Are you sitting in a chair?
I have a chaise where a lot of sunshine comes in through the window in the bedroom.
Okay.
So I don't even turn a light on. Okay. Middle of the day, I'll or in the morning. Okay. When I wake up early every day. So when I sleep in until 7, it's a big deal.
Okay.
So I'll sit in that chaise and I'll read a little bit. In my car in the morning, I bring it in the cars, have it when I park. I'm there for maybe 25 minutes, and I'll sit in my car and flip through it. That's how I always would read comics. I don't know what I'll do when I have to take the train again to work, but that's when all the trades I have, I can read there. But, I've just really enjoyed reading classic run. And that's the thing, right, is trying to get something that is worthy of reading in that format. So, like, Why the Last Man, or... you know what I was going to say... I noticed a lot in omnibus shopping and hunting was the amount of omnibus that DC has put out for New 52.
Yeah.
And it's such a maligned tag or brand now, where people make fun of the New 52.
Yeah.
But looking back at it, I'm not saying the whole line was good, but there was a lot of good stuff that came out of it, like the Batman and Robin from Tomasi is arguably as good, perhaps better than Snyder's Batman. I know some people prefer it.
I would agree.
Well, some people
emotional.
Some people prefer it, and there's a lot of merit to that argument. The Animal Man from Jeff Lemire, and I forget the artist's name now, that he was key to the production of that book being what it was. I want to say Trad Moore, but it's not. It's Travis something. Oh, it's going to bother me now. But that was a very good 29-issue story that tied in with Swamp Thing. That was worthwhile read. The Flash from Manipul's beautiful artwork. It's not the greatest story.
No, it's not.
But what do you have to compare a Manipul and Buccellato story to? Jeff Johns and Mark Waid are the two people that really come to mind.
It's true.
And artistically, he blows it out of the water. And he in a way, I mean, pre-New 52, I guess Jeff Johns was dealing with Barry Allen, but this is the first time Barry Allen has really had an ongoing.
I mean, he had 10 issues before the Flashpoint happened.
He did. And Manapul was drawing that.
He was.
And so now this is the first, like a brand new era where this character has long been dead and people now know him as the main Flash based on the TV show. So I feel like the TV show influenced a lot of the kind of story that you get in that book and the characters. But that's another one. The Grayson was a celebrated book. Wonder Woman from Chang and Azzarello. Like, there's just a lot of stuff that now they're kind of, I don't know if they're trying to say like, hey man, this wasn't so bad after all. Where look at all these collections, but there is a lot of stuff that's there that was worthwhile that I've been able to appreciate a second go around.
It wasn't all bad. It got a really bad. I mean, here's the thing: they made 52 books a month. Some of them are gonna be shit.
Yeah.
I mean, like, what else can you expect? That's a ton of books.
It's way too much. And I think Marvel perhaps had a better ratio of good books to bad books when they did Marvel Now, but there's a lot of forgettable stuff there too.
Oh yeah,
right,
a lot of bad stuff.
So it you know, it goes both ways.
I don't hate the period. I think there was a lot of good things behind it, and I understood why they did it.
It was a good shot in the arm for the comic shops at the time.
Was it?
Well, from what Daryl was telling me, he said that was a good time business-wise because of the incentive that they could return books that weren't doing well. He goes, it was kind to the shops to say, we're not just going to leave you stuck with this.
Yeah.
But I don't own a shop, so I don't know. I stopped reading in the beginning. When they announced New 52 and they said everything's... I jumped off for 2 years.
I was reading the Green Lantern books, but they never felt the same. Mm-hmm. I was kind of done. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. I come in and out of DC. Like, there's things I like. But one thing I always liked, because I was not a DC fan growing up, I liked the sense of legacy. I liked the sense that there was things I didn't know. And then wiping all that away, I didn't love that. Because I liked that there was this whole world I didn't understand. I liked that I could read JSA and be like, who are these people? It's interesting, but like, I don't know these characters. That's okay. I didn't need them to all be wiped away.
Yeah. I think that was for me too what turned me off, because I had been, you know, I guess a DC zombie. I was reading Green Lantern and Batman and Justice League at the time, and of course Superman, and then I'm collecting all these books, and it was getting to a point where I'm like, I'm drowning in these books.
Yeah.
Trying to keep up with it, and now it doesn't count anymore.
Nope.
Which is
it's silly.
It's silly for us
still, to, because it still counts to you.
Exactly.
If you liked it, it still matters.
Exactly. But I was just like, okay, you know what? I'm having a hard time keeping up. I'm not reading all of these singles, and now you're telling me it's restarting. I'm out.
Yeah, I'm at a weird spot, too, because like, I bought a lot of the New 52 era trades, but I don't think I'm going to go back to them, and I don't know why. But like, I don't know if it's just because maybe it's because like, they don't kind of matter anymore, because you know, it's hard to know what matters and what matter. Like, but I don't even know why that matters. Like, I'd struggle with that myself. But like, you know, I have a bunch of those books, but I don't know if I'll go back and reread them. They're very of the time too.
And it's funny.
I have the Manapul Flash stuff, and like, but the story is not that good. It's not that interesting, but the art is beautiful. Like, it's really that's a hard one for me, because I think some of the storytelling things that Francis did were so interesting, and panel layouts and...
Beautiful. It's beautiful.
Some crazy imaginative stuff, but the stories weren't that great. And how do you reconcile that? Now, one thing I remember from that period is listening to Buccellato talk on the Comic Vine podcast back when that was a thing. I don't know if you ever listened to Comic Vine. And then they used to have a lot of episodes with James Robinson, who was on like every week. And I used to love listening to James Robinson speak. And I really miss actually that, because he was such an interesting person to be able to listen to. I actually tried to get him on the show, and I don't know why. It fell through at the last minute, but that was years ago. I should try again. But he was really interesting to hear too, because he had just an interesting perspective on things. And he felt kind of somehow divorced from everything. Actually, did you ever read James Robinson's Airboy?
No, but I heard it was very, like, it was very meta in the sense that it was him trying to figure out, like, he had lost his way and he was trying to find himself again.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, I've heard quite a few things about it. It's wild.
It's very graphic at first. Yeah. the stuff that happens there is, whoa, don't let the kids near it.
Yeah. I heard that. I flipped through it, actually. I'm like, oh, all right, okay. Yeah. This is what they said it was.
It's very interesting. I like those books that kind of come out of nowhere and surprise you. I don't know if you've ever read Mark Millar and Raphael Albuquerque's Huck.
Yes. That's a great book. That's a very good book.
That came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
I like those books that kind of take you by surprise. You don't really know what you're getting, and you read it, and you hear like one or two people talking about it, and you're like, wow, this is really something. That book really... I don't know if it quite stuck the landing, but the first couple of issues were so... It was more emotional than I've ever seen Mark Millar be. I think Mark Millar is more plot than characterization typically, and that's not a bad thing. But that felt more character, at least for the first couple of issues.
Yeah, I for a minute I got really into Mark Millar books. I found that I like it's fun, it's fast paced, it keeps you bombastic, keeps you at the edge of your seat. You know that this could very well become a movie,
yeah,
and
that's true.
And he's got pretty fun ideas.
Yes, he does.
Not all of them stick the landing, like you said, but. There's a lot of stuff that is quite a bit of fun to read, and I think of more books that were enjoyable than ones that left me feeling like,
yeah,
oh, that was horrible.
Yeah.
So there was a run where I was reading Huck, and I read the Ultimates, mm-hmm, Omnibus, but then even his
How does that age now?
It's very of its time in regards to dialogue. And references, because it's very reference heavy.
Yeah, I guess it is, yeah.
And that's the part that ages it. I really like Brian Hitch's work. I think he was just the right person for that sort of cinematic style.
It's weird to see. I've been reading some, like, you know, X-Men trades in here, and you get like old issues of Hitch in like the, you know, mid-90s doing X-Men with like bright colors, and it feels so weird because my formative time really getting to know Brian Hitch was with a very different color palette. So seeing him on like traditional real four color, you know, classic X-Men books is weird. It doesn't feel right because I'm like, no, he needs more muted colors. Like, mm-hmm, he needs it to not be so garish. He needs more earthy tones, you know. He needs, you know, but I guess it's because I think of Ultimates when I think of Hitch, which may or may not be fair, but that's definitely one of his bigger books.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about that book because it was so of its time, a time when the Avengers weren't going to work, or at least the ideas that the Avengers were kind of, like, they didn't even call it Ultimate Avengers for a reason. Mm-hmm. They thought the Avengers name didn't add anything, which is crazy to think of now because the Avengers has become this huge juggernaut of a franchise.
And I think that book had it's a lot of influence.
Oh, for sure.
What became what you see in the movies and some of the characterization. And just the way the movies looked.
I'm glad we never got that Captain America, though.
Yeah. Like, that was the part that threw me off when I was reading. I'm like, I don't like this Cap.
He's a little too hard-edged.
Yes. You know,
he wasn't quite the Boy Scout we're used to.
Yes.
And why do we like that version of Cap? Because we kind of like that paternal figure. The one is, look, you know, people complain sometimes about Superman being, you know, too much like, you know, the big brother or like
your dad's superhero,
but
yeah.
I'm okay with that. You know, I kind of, because my favorite, like, well, and Tomasi did a great Superman, you know, as a father, as someone who you really felt like they mattered, like, you know, that he cared about people. And it's not a bad thing to care about others. And I feel like the people who get Superman right are the people who understand that it's okay to have empathy. It's okay for Superman to, you know, to want to protect people. I don't love Grant Morrison, but his All-Star Superman is a perfect story of, you know, of all the nice things about Superman. Like and I know they've made a meme out of this at times too, but, you know, with Superman and the girl who's thinking about killing herself and jumping off the building, and how he just shows up and he's like, you know, your psychiatrist really was just running late today. Like, he cares. Although I don't know if you've ever saw the meme that was making fun of, I think it was, I guess, Snyder's version of Superman, where he like pushes her off or whatever. Like it's very brutal, something like that. But like just that his version didn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the classic Superman did. And I don't know. As I get older, the more I enjoy that kind of stuff. I don't need always to have these, you know, people kind of deconstructing things, making people harder edged. I think, like, I don't think I would enjoy Ultimates as much now if it came out today as I did 10, 15 years ago, whenever it came out. Because I think I was younger. I wanted something a little bit more harder edged, maybe. And I thought it was really cool. But I think now I kind of like the old school. I like, mm-hmm, I don't know. I like heroes to be heroes. I don't need my heroes to be gray.
I felt like that when I was reading it. I was like, I'm not used to this anymore.
No.
At a time when I read that, I'm like, this is... I remember reading it in mid-2000s, And I was like, this is kick-ass. This is cool stuff. Oh, yeah. Reading it now in one... I'm happy I did it in one sitting because the way that it ended, I felt like, okay, yeah. I like where I've gone on this journey where, yes, it felt like a superhero Avengers book. It got to that point. But yeah. In the beginning, I was like, this makes me uncomfortable. These characters are not likable at all.
No.
In a lot of ways. And I was like, I don't feel connected to this the way that I thought I would. But reading it all together, it was very good. You know, but it is a product of its time.
It is, and it's definitely that, you know, again, in that era, you have Dr. Light raping Sue Dibney. Like, you have, you know, comics becoming uncomfortably realistic, and that's what Ultimates was. And it's good, but it's of its time. It's of a certain specific... If you're looking for a feel-good superhero story, do not read this book. That's not what this is about. It's about superheroes in the real world, is, I guess, the easiest way to put it. Everyone has flaws, you know, and you have interesting relationships you don't see anywhere else, like Cap and Wasp. You know, that's never existed really anywhere else. It's interesting, but yeah, it's not something I want to read as much anymore. It's interesting because there was a time I thought that would be a perennial read for me, and I'm like, I don't know. I'd rather read classic Avengers.
You know, it's also your sensibilities change as you get older and your values change too, right? You can suddenly relate to something simpler, like you said before, about this last year, as scary as it was, that simplicity of expectation, you appreciate something else.
That's true.
Right? So that not having to feel you need to be somewhere and not feeling that pressure that I'm not doing enough, just to sit and be. Now I can enjoy this thing innocently. And sometimes you want to read comics and take it for what they are instead of like, I need something that's super avant-garde.
Yeah. This is going to sound really stupid. There's something about the original kind of four-color process as opposed to the more modern coloring that I do find very soothing. I find if like I read... you know, a book from like the 90s or earlier, it soothes me in a way that modern books don't. And it's just because of the colors. It's nothing else. And I know that. Like, if I see a recolored book of an old material, I won't experience it the same way. It does take me out of it. Even if the coloring is quote unquote better. There's something about the original color work. I don't know if you've ever read, I think we've talked about this before, so I apologize for repeating myself. The Absolute Killing Joke. Have you ever read that before?
I know exactly what you're referring to. Yeah, the colors were muted on the when they did that deluxe edition of it. Was it Brian Bolin?
Yeah, so he redid the colors.
Yeah,
And I actually kind of like the originals. I think there's a different there's just a different feel to it. It's interesting because it you know, it's the original artist going back and coloring it himself
using the way he wanted to.
Yeah, and using modern techniques. So who knows if it's really what he would have done. It's very interesting to see something like that. I kind of like the original more. It's such a weird... That's a weird one because it's not like the company went back in and recolored it. The actual artist did. Like, the artist wanted it this way. And yet, there are certain things I would object to, and I think that it didn't necessarily make it better.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like the George Lucas going back and touching things up in Star Wars, where it's like, it doesn't make it better, even though that's what you would have done back then if you had the tech.
That's what he wanted. So it's his stuff. Like,
and I respect it. I do. And
I'm very happy to have both versions of the Killing Joke. And I was really happy. And I think when I bought it, to be honest, I didn't realize that they were both there. And then seeing them, I was like, I'm really glad they're both here because I can appreciate the differences, and then I can make a definitive decision on which one I like more. And that's kind of nice.
Yeah.
How often do you get to do that?
No, I know that the Thor Walt Simonson was recolored too.
That's one of the problems with it. Like, I look at it and I'm like, it's not quite the same.
And I did see, for me, my first reading of that.
All the Tales of the Batman books, they're all like recolored too. Like, I want old school Batman to feel like old school Batman, and I feel like it's not. It's slightly different. Like, if they just had more of an authentic, you know, reproduction program, I would be more appreciative.
I feel like the epics are not affected that way.
I would agree, but I'm not a colorist, so I don't know if that's actually true.
Because I do get that feeling when I read an epic.
I do miss newsprint, though. There's something warm about newsprint. Like even when we were buying books in the 90s, they weren't on really newsprint anymore. They were already starting to shift into the more like glossy, right? Like, I don't know if you remember the X-Men books of like the mid 90s, you had the regular edition, the deluxe edition. The deluxe edition had the better paper. And then they just got rid of the old, you know, regular newsstand ones and just moved to deluxe paper. I miss newsprint, and I feel like I would, it's one of those things like, you know, people want the best quality, but you know, the price is higher. People aren't buying books as much anymore because they're so expensive. But they really, if they cut costs and put it back on newsprint, would it really be the worst thing? Because you're still getting the better color techniques.
I heard from Neil Adams that it wasn't actually cheaper doing newsprint. He said that's why they switched over, because the people that they found at Quebec Or was the printing place in Canada. Yeah. His daughter actually was the one who found it. He said it was cheaper to do it in that paper, which was nicer paper. Yeah, according to what he said.
Huh.
So, but I do like the recent DC traits, the paper that they have in there. It's kind of that cross between newsprint, but it's not as flimsy, but it has that sort of texture.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes sense. Did you get the new Birds of Prey trade, the Gil Simone, the recent Birds of Prey?
You know, I did. I don't remember it, though.
And it has that sort of...
Okay.
It's not newsprint, but it's enough of that texture to feel it.
The same paper they used in the recent Justice League, like the DeMatteis era?
Because
they did a relatively recent collection of that. It was like 18 issues or something.
I don't have that one. Okay. But it's in the Justice League.
How do you not have that? You love DeMatteis. He's your best omnibus. Friend. Oh, the omnibus. All right.
But I had that omnibus a couple years ago. I bought that when it came out.
Before you were friends.
Before, yes. That was in preparation for the first episode we did. I read that one then. Yeah, so it's a scary number of omnibus that I bought this year, but I've been reading them.
That's good.
Which is what I'm happy about. That's
a classic thing you do see on all these forums, is people talking about how many books they haven't read. So that's, you know, that's kind of nice that you've actually read them.
I'm not reading all of them as fast as I buy them, but I am reading them. That's the thing. I'm like,
see, that should be what you limit yourself to. Once you've read one, you can buy one.
You're right. But we know that that's not as easy for collectors.
No, especially when things go to print.
It's like the price is at this now. That should be your
motivator then. Like every night, I got to read 2-3 issues of this.
It's more a price thing.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
That's true.
But so when you see that omnibus for 40% off, now's the time to buy it, whether or not I'm ready to read it.
True.
Because then it's going to be regular price again. But yeah, it wasn't a good game tonight, Chapman.
Oh my God, it was awful.
Yeah, and it's getting chilly out here, so we should probably wrap this up.
That is true. I'm shorts and a t-shirt.
You are.
And the longer it goes, I'm like, oh my God, I'm cold.
I see you rubbing your legs, and I'm like, this guy's freezing. We're just chatting.
It's okay. I will chat about comics in the cold, coldness. It's okay.
But we were able to sneak in a podcast, which is good. And
I like to say sneak in, like it wasn't your plan all along.
Well, this is the thing. We were talking like regular gentlemen for a while, and it was like, maybe we're not going to podcast. And I said, you know what? We have to. What the heck? So I'm happy we snuck one in, another chatting with Chapman.
Yeah.
And this was really nice. I know the weather is starting to get chillier, but we snuck in a nice night of being able to sit out here, and it was great. I hope to do this again. If we can't get to baseball games, this will be a nice a nice thing to do instead.
For sure.
All right, dude. Thank you so much. Check out Comic Shenanigans, because you've got everybody on your show.
We have some good stuff coming.
You've got a lot of good stuff coming, and a lot of good stuff that you had this year. It was a big year for you.
I guess it was. I mean, the big one, I feel like every time I say his name, either a genie's going to come out or people are going to shoot me. But Roger Stern was the big one for this year, because I got him twice.
And you're a jerk.
Yeah, you and Dan Gavazdin are both on the same wavelength there, that I'm a bit of a jerk about it. I think I probably bragged more than I should, both of you. But I was just so happy about it. It's one of those things where, like, you want to share how happy you are. And if I go to my wife and say, Roger Stern's doing the show, she's like, Roger who? And I'm like, I wish Eric was here. You know, like, it's one of those things. But, yeah, the upcoming episodes, I'm very excited that we're going to have Chris Claremont back to talk about Fantastic Four. I don't know how that'll go, but I'm really excited to at least give it a shot. We've got Michael Lark coming on the show. I'm really pumped for that, because he's one of those ones where you can't really find him that easily on social media, etc. Like, he's there, but he doesn't really respond to anything. But because I had Stefano Gariano on the show, I guess last week or the week before, he was a really good advocate. He really enjoyed being on the show. He's like, oh, I'll reach out to Michael for you. I'm like, oh, that's amazing. Thank you.
That's awesome.
That's the highest compliment I can get. Actually, the highest compliment is that he's actually going through my catalog and listening to episodes. I'm like, that's pretty cool for me. You know?
It
like,
is cool.
You know, he's like, a professional is listening to other interviews of his colleagues and other professionals that I've done. That's pretty neat. So that's Michael Lark coming on. And there's one other one we have coming up. Ron Garney, we're trying to reschedule. That got pushed around. Pat Olive is going to be on the show. Mark Wade promised that he was going to come on sometime in the fall. So, you know, stuff. I know. You're like, you asshole.
Yeah.
You and your Mark Wade.
Yeah, you asshole, for real. Here I am trying to just get local guys to be on the show. It's hard enough to get Adam Chapman, the great El Chapo Adam Chapman. Oh, if I could fit you in. Because I'm busy talking to Mark Wade and all these other legends.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's amazing. El Chapo.
I'm just waiting for you. Well, I got Steve Ditko coming in. And
from Stan the grave.
Lee, yeah, Stan Lee and Steve Ditko are coming from the grave. They want to talk to me. They've been doing a back catalog of all the conversations
I
had.
Wish did interviews. And obviously he's very old. And that's why you don't hear from him. Just because the few times I've ever seen an interview with him, I've always enjoyed it and I've always liked his voice, is John Demeter Sr. There's not a lot of interviews out there that you can watch. There's one on the Daredevil DVD from the movie that was really interesting, but it's all about Daredevil. It's not really about the rest of his career. But he's just such an interesting guy to listen to, and he was there.
He was there.
You know, and Roy Thomas is probably one of the other ones too. Roy Thomas, I could listen to him pontificate forever because he's just so fascinating. His importance to the comic industry feels often overlooked. And like his importance to Conan. Like, I was reading a thing the other day about how Conan wasn't even their first pick to adapt sword and sorcery style, but the other one they wanted they couldn't get because it was too expensive, or the guy wanted too much money. So he reached out to the people representing the Conan estate, and they offered them a certain amount of money, and they ended up taking him up on it. And he was really excited about it. And one of the reasons he wrote it is that he committed more per issue than he was licensed or like authorized to actually to give them to license the book. So he said, well, how about I take a reduced page rate and I'll write it. And the reason why they got Barry Windsor Smith and not John Buscema originally to illustrate it is because Buscema was too expensive, and they were like, no, you got to get cheaper talent because we got to keep the cost in this book low. But Conan became a huge thing in and of itself as a comic adaptation, but at the time no one really thought it would work except for Roy, and it wasn't even their first choice.
Yeah.
And yet it became this huge thing, and it's this thing that everyone identifies with Roy Thomas is Conan, but it almost didn't even happen. And that kind of stuff I find fascinating.
Yeah, I talking to John Roy Thomas, I came to that realize you kind of know these things, but you come to realizations that fandom exists because of people like Roy Thomas. Like,
he is fandom.
That's the thing,
yeah,
right?
Like, he's alter ego, He's it's fascinating. Actually, and that's one of the embarrassments I have, is that I am relatively recent convert to alter ego and to Back Issue Magazine. I love Back Issue Magazine. That is like catnip for me. Like, that is, I don't know how I went this long in my life without knowing it existed, and then finding issues is not always easy. But I don't know if you've ever read Back Issue Magazine.
I'd probably love it.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, it's a magazine all about the past. They don't really like to go past maybe the mid-90s. That's kind of their breakoff point generally. They like to be more classic. But, they really get into the nooks and crannies. There's a whole issue about basically breaking down every issue of What If, the first volume, and kind of like having a couple paragraphs in each issue talking to the people behind it, why they did certain things, how these different issues even happened. It's fascinating. And like, they go into everything. They've been going for like 125 issues now. It comes out only a few times a year, so it's been like 15 years of this book. But if you can get your hands on some issues, I think you really like it.
Probably.
I love the history of it all. I like to see how it all fits.
I miss comic book media, like Wizard Magazine and stuff like that.
And that wasn't even that good, but it was what we were used to.
It was, yeah, that's the thing. We like, had something.
I remember as a kid getting comic shop news, because you didn't have the internet. And that was exciting. That's where you found out the new stuff that was coming out. And then you had Wizard, and Wizard was doing the same thing. And Wizard was very much like the Maxim of comics. And I mean that in every way. Like, there's good things about it, but there's some really bad things about it. And I feel like equating it to Maxim is as honest as I can get. Because that's what it was. It was this big, flashy book. And it was really designed for teenage boys, just like Maxim. So
yeah, no, it's true.
And it really did its job. And in that price guide, it was like catnip at the time too. Like it was really of the era when everyone cared about prices, and it didn't matter, but like it did, but it didn't, you know.
It was part of the culture.
I remember every year before going to the before it was the Fan Expo. Sorry, I know we're trying to stop, and I just kept going. They had the Canadian National Comic Book Expo, I think what it was originally called. I remember going to like the second annual, and now it's this huge, you know, multimedia conglomerate. But long before then, I remember going to that and. What's my point? Shoot, I lost the point. I lost the thread. Why was I talking about going there?
Wizard.
So I remember spending like the weeks leading up to the con, going through the price guides, trying to figure out all the first appearances I was going to try and find, prices I was okay with, issues I was missing, and like that was the excitement, you know? And when you get older, suddenly you can buy the things you want and then you don't need anything anymore. And so the books you really wanted, you own them, or they're just too expensive and you don't really want to bother anyway, and your relationship with cons starts to change, and what you're looking for is changing. And I think the last time I was really excited about a con was probably like 2005, because that was the last time I was like, I'm going to buy a ton of books.
Wow.
Well, I think I'd gone through a really bad breakup that summer, and all this money I was going to use to travel to see my girlfriend at the time, I'm like, let's blow it on comics. So I have a lot of Daredevil comics that are specifically from that con, where my buddy and I just went through and just bought a ton. He's like, you got all this money from not seeing this girl, let's go buy all these comics. I don't need them anymore because the epics will soon replace them, but it's nice that
it's
I have
a memory
them.
Though it's a memory.
It's definitely a weird memory, yes.
But it's still a good one. You had it was a good con, right?
It was a good con, because
that's all that matters.
My buddy isn't even into comics, he's more into the sci-fi stuff, but he loves a challenge. He loves a mission. The mission was to find this. The other comic book mission I had for years was to find all the chapters of Hands of the Mandarin, which was a crossover in Iron Man, which I remember I was in Philly in 2008, and I found every chapter but one, and because of me, I couldn't buy it. I'm like, I can't do it. If I can't have them all, don't want it. And then a few years later, they put it out in trade, and I was like, oh my God, it's happening. It's finally happening. Because I had read the first chapter I'd ever read of that. It was like chapter 4 of 6 in 1992. It was a birthday gift, like throw-in, that someone just kind of threw in some comics. I wasn't even buying comics at the time yet. And I had never finished the storyline, but I loved it, and I wanted to be able to read it. So finally the trade comes. I'm like, I'm buying this. Was it good? Not really. But it was such an important thing to me, because I had always read chapter 4 over and over again, so I couldn't wait to get to chapter 4 and see all the stuff I'd missed, and then see everything that I knew was supposed to come out of afterwards. So I promise I'm done.
It's all good. Hey, man, we could be here all night talking about this stuff, and I love it. I don't mind at all.
Yeah, I like to talk comics, you know? Yeah, so
that's our thing. And we probably don't have that many people who can talk about it the way we understand it.
No, definitely not.
With our level of OCD and FOMO.
It's so interesting, too, because, like, it's a very niche hobby. But within the hobby, there's so many other niches,
right?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
So, like, half the stuff, if it's not in the Epic collections, I don't think I could talk to Curtis about it. Because he'd be like, is it an Epic? I'm like, no, never will be. All right. Talk to someone else.
Right, right. And I'm in a little bit of all of those niches, exactly. Unfortunately and fortunately.
You're more of, if it's in an omnibus, I'm your guy.
Well, Epic. I have Epics, yeah. Omnibus.
How
recent
many epics do you have?
Close to 50.
Close to 50?
Close to 50.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
50?
Close.
Which lines are you buying again?
I have of Avengers.
Okay.
Not every single one.
Okay.
Eras.
Okay.
I have Captain America, Gruenwald stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get the J.M. DeMatteis stuff that they're reprinting now.
Do you have the Captain not an epic?
Yes.
You do?
I do. Because I bought that before Epics came out.
Okay.
I have Amazing Spider-Man. I have a couple.
All of them?
Not all of them.
Which one?
Again, eras. Oh. So after, I'm trying to collect from the Jerry Conway era up until 300.
Okay.
That era is what I'm probably going to get.
Okay.
Because I have the other, the Stan Lee stuff in Omnibus, right?
Okay.
What else do I have a couple of Iron Man. I have all of the Moon Knight. I have...
Moon Knight, eh?
Martin was selling them. Martin Slam Duncan. Oh, yeah. He was selling his Epic collection, so I snatched up all his... So I have a couple of whales because of him.
Yeah.
I have a couple of good whales thanks to Martin. Hmm. Some Wolverine.
Okay.
Early Wolverine. Yeah. Some early X-Men. No, not early X-Men. Claremont X-Men.
One of the Daredevils I have is apparently a giant whale. The Heart of Darkness, I think it is. Or one of the Innocenti ones. Apparently it's really hard to get.
I have the Final Threat Avengers. That one I was really happy to get.
That is one you often see. yeah. people talking about.
Yeah.
That and the not an epic trial of the Yellow Jacket. That's another big whale for people.
Yeah. So I have a couple of
50 though. Wow. That's impressive.
I should count. I should read, but it was close. It was
you
close.
Sure you want to count?
I don't mind. It doesn't bother me. No, it doesn't bother me. I don't have shame yet.
No.
Well, why? Yeah. Why? Why?
I don't have shame.
It's what I love.
Yeah, I guess I'm more like, my wife gave me our basement, and I've run out of room, and so I'm ashamed of that. That, like, you know, she gave me this big room. Now, that being said, like, there's a lot of other stuff in there that's not necessarily comics, but, like, I have a lot of comics, and then I have the trades, and then I have the card covers, and then it spilled out, and some of it's not, like, when I first moved here 7 years ago, it was more neat and tidy, and now there's stuff that's not there anymore, and that is in my garage, and I have, like, singles in the garage that I was really going, like, bringing
that's where I that's where itself. I start to get that level of anxiety.
Yeah, I have a lot of anxiety. If I really go down there, I get really anxious and upset about everything. And I like for two, like I've been wanting to sell comics for like 2 years. I've been wanting to sell like probably like 2,000 books, and I just it took me like a year to finally put together like a comprehensive inventory of everything and where everything was, and then I was going to send it to like, you know, B&B, and this is like a year and a half ago, and then a pandemic happened. I'm feeling it's probably not the right time to sell books. They probably don't want to buy anything.
No,
but
they're not.
But it's hard, so I don't know what to do.
I you know, and that's the other thing too, is like when I upgrade my collections,
like, I can't dump them in the garbage.
No, I donate them to libraries.
Yeah.
I give them to some people at work who have kids that are learning to read. I'll resell them.
Like, it's hard because like you spent money on this stuff.
You know what? Yeah. You gotta just enjoy what you had when you had it, and that's the thing, right? You can't keep it. You can't take everything with you. You can't.
Oh, for sure. Oh, and I don't want like $3 an issue. I wouldn't mind 20 cents an issue. Like,
yeah.
You know, I'm not looking for something crazy. I just, you know, and some of it I probably would end up trying to replace and trade, but you know, and I would like to know it went to somebody, but it's hard to know. Anyways, all right. Let's wrap it up. Yes.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you everybody for listening, and we will be back soon. Remember to listen to Comic Shenanigans as well. You will enjoy it very, very much. All right, everybody. Have a good night. Have a good day. Have a good week. Stay safe. Have fun.
Peace.